I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Parents, students, teachers, and other school officials got quite a shock after scores from this year's FCAT writing test dropped dramatically. The number of fourth graders who received an acceptable score on the FCAT dropped from 81% to 27%. 10th graders saw a similar drop. In response, the State Board of Education held an emergency meeting and changed the passable score mark on a 6-point scale from 4 to a 3. Now the entire education community is wondering how best to proceed. What kind of investigation should there be? What do the scores mean for students, and what do they mean for schools? Ahead on Intersection, we talk with local and state education officials to figure out what happened on the FCAT. And here to discuss the latest results from the FCAT are Mike Cahill. He's president of the Orange County Teachers Association. Mike, good to have you in.
Good morning.
And also with us is Winter Park High School physics teacher Gail Hodges. Gail, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we're joined on the phone by Kathleen Shanahan, who is the chairman of the Florida Board of Education. Kathleen, good to speak with you.
Good morning, everybody.
So I want to start with you, Kathleen. This emergency meeting had an air of drama about it. Obviously, the board felt compelled to take action. But what do we know so far about why these FCAT test scores were so much lower than anticipated?
Well, I think we explained it pretty thoroughly in the conversation that we had with about 800 public participants. In the course of Florida, believing that they want their children to compete globally, we have standards and tests and measurements that we do every year to measure how much a child has learned in the year of education. And with the FCAT writing scores, we had last year increased both the bar as well as increased the rigor of the test, which meant that there was a lot of focus in the new test on the English content and the ability for both punctuation, spelling, use of context, and so the scoring was much tougher this year than in previous years. And so that impact on the school grades was of a reason, from my perspective as a state board chairman, to have a conversation with the rest of the board, since we can't talk to each other, and say, did the department do enough when we raised the standards last July? Did we do enough professional development? Is there anything that we should look at vis-a-vis an adjustment for this year from a perspective of impact on the school grades without walking back the rigor of the content of the test? And that was the decision made by the board last, I think it was Wednesday or Thursday.
So you're setting up the scenario. There was a new FCAT standard out there called FCAT 2.0, and of course there were new standards for how these tests were going to be graded. But obviously everybody all around didn't anticipate that there was going to be such a huge drop in the score levels.
Well, I don't think we do. I don't think we make adjustments to testing. Again, the goal is to educate a child that can compete in the global world. And when you look at where the U.S. schools are compared, we used to be one or two in the world. We're now 25th. And so our public policy challenge in Florida is how do we, working within a system of public education, create a system for kids to compete globally. And we have been on a course in Florida for well over 10 years, 12 years, to raise the standard of performance by understanding what child is learning what in the course of a year on a whole segment of subjects. And there's been much evolution in that. So the FCAT is now only one test. I mean, we now have end-of-course tests, and we added, I mean, there's a writing test. Before, it was graded very leniently just in terms of could they, you know, put together a sentence. We raised the standard of what was expected in terms of the review because we are headed towards Common Core. There are 45 states and PARC testing that it's going to be a national test, that it's going to be a very rigorous test as we look at raising the competitiveness of the nation's education system in terms of what the kids are learning. And this is an effort led by and supported by President Obama and Arne Duncan in 2014 and 2015 that will be instituted across the country in the 46 states that have signed on to those standards. So Florida is ahead of its curve in terms of implementing more rigor in these tests, but I don't walk back from what is teaching us. I think it teaches parents what their children are learning, and it gives them the ability to go get extra help either through the schools or in their off time at home in terms of what are the skill sets that their kids need to have to, again, compete globally in this world today.
Mm-hmm. Mike Cahill, what was the reaction at the local level in Orange County? Any idea that these scores were going to have such a dramatic difference between this year and last year?
No. What happens with these kinds of testing and these high-stakes testings, which we don't agree with in the educational area, is that it labels everybody. I mean, here's a student that puts everything into it all of a sudden, thinking that they're going to get a great grade on the writing test, and all of a sudden, due to the fact that the Department of Education changes this, all of a sudden, teachers and students and parents are all up in arms. And, you know, you can see more and more of protesting on this constant testing instead of actually teaching and learning.
So tell me, Gail Hodges, what are you hearing from...
So can I just ask Mike a question on that, though? How,
sure.
Mike, how would you learn, how would you measure the success of teaching and learning in the course of a year for a child in a classroom if it was not a test?
Well, I have to agree with you on one thing, Kathleen. This idea of having nationalized testing. I always thought that the states should be able to go, if you were a student, leave Georgia and come to Florida and get the same quality education. So that would be something that you would need to look at. You got,
I know,
we
but
have
so
to,
you understand we, that that's where we're going in 2014 and 2015. We're going to have national testing in science, math, and English arts. We
true.
Have already started in kindergarten and first and second grade this year in a couple of those categories. So I don't know how that's different than what we're currently testing.
Well, what I am saying here is that we agree with you in the rigorous learning part.
Right.
It's the testing. If you're spending 80 days out of a teach out of 180 days testing instead of going through the process of learning. So I think that the educators have to sit down.
Are there that many days testing days in Orlando?
Well,
I
have a
sir.
Teacher to the left of me that could explain that.
I don't think they spend 80 days testing. You just said that they spend 80 days testing for an FCAT test. That's not my understanding of the test.
Well, first of all, you're spending 100-some-odd days just preparing for the test. But I'll let Ms. Hodges, Dr.
Well,
Hodges.
I'd like to be perfectly clear before you go to Ms. Hodges that we don't promote teaching to the test. We promote measuring a child's learning in the course of a year. And you haven't answered my question yet to say how exactly would you do that? You said you supported standardized testing, which is what we're headed for in 2014, 2015, that will be across the nation. And they are the same sort of testing that we're doing now with our end of course exams as well as the FCAT exam. I'm trying to see what the difference is. Like, how do you measure a child in a year's worth of learning? How would you measure that if it's not a test?
Well, at the end of the year, yes, there's an end-of-year testing, and that's what we agree. But I'm going to let Gail speak on how many tests she goes through in one year. Gail?
We have started the end-of-course test in my high school, and we have it for Algebra 1, Geometry. American History was brought online. And biology. In the last 6 weeks of school, we have been testing every day. Some students are in and out. Some students are out more than in. And it's very difficult if you're not in one of these end-of-year course exams to continue teaching because you don't know when the student will be there and when the student will not be. And it's not fair to punish a student to say, okay, you'll have to come after school to make up this work because the state decided we needed a test. That's the problem we're having. when all of them hit.
How would you measure, Gail, how would you measure how much a child learns in the course of a year for algebra?
I have no problem.
Without there being a test.
I have no problem with the end-of-year course exam, but that's not what really is going on. You have a mid-benchmark test in the middle of the first 9 weeks, and then you have a benchmark test at the end of the 9 weeks. Then you have one for the second 9 weeks. Then you have one for the end of the second 9 weeks. Then you have a semester exam. Then you have one for the middle of the third, the end of the third, and so on through the fourth. So it's not just a test at the end. It's five or six tests along the way that the teacher has now lost that particular time to teach their subjects and get their students ready for the end-of-year course exam.
And do the results of those tests not help the teachers to know the different levels of the students in their classroom in terms of how they're learning what specific aspects of what they're trying to teach?
I would agree with that statement, except for the fact that the days they're taking the test is away from the days they could be studying for the end-of-course exam. And then the other problem is, if you're giving end-of-course exams for 5 weeks, then it's not really the end of the course, is it? It's in the beginning or in the middle of the fourth 9 weeks. So some of these kids have taken end-of-year course exams at the beginning of April or the end mid-April, and the course doesn't get over till June. So now where do we go with that extra time? They're not going to be tested on it, and now the students find no validity in learning it because there's no test associated with it. So if we're going to have end-of-year course exams, and I have no problem with that, then let's give them at the end of the year and give the teachers an equal opportunity to teach all their material required.
I think that makes sense. I mean, I didn't know when the end-of-course exams were given, and that's helpful information, so I appreciate knowing that, Gail.
You're welcome.
Let me jump in here. I do want to come back a little bit to this situation here with the most recent batch of scores that came out regarding reading and writing. Kathleen Shanahan, the Board of Education moved the passing score mark on this most recent FCAP from a 4 to a 3. Does moving that passing mark by one number really make a big difference? How much of an impact does it have?
Well, you first of all, you're mixing two things, because the writing was the one issue that was addressed, and I think it was addressed for a series of reasons, which I'm happy to explain one more time, in that we raised the rigor of the test and we raised the test score last July. All the superintendents were notified. I think there were two reasons that the Board of Education reduced the measurement of 4 to 3 was because, one, there had not been a parallel path, professional development, advocacy, sort of full bore briefing from the Department of Education, from the state of Florida, to every district in a way that it was like, we are really raising the rigor, which means you're raising the specific areas of the test in terms of what you're measuring that you have not been measuring before. Sentence structure, commas, punctuation, spelling.
The fundamentals of writing.
The fundamentals of writing. And so then we being the education department, briefed the scorers. There were two scorers for every test, and they were briefed to now really look at those content areas with a new lens on year. That's the first time that's been done. Usually it's been looked at with a very lenient glaze in terms of the actual fundamentals of writing, and more for, are they getting a concept across?
Yes, so, and so what does
I
it what does it mean?
Taking all that data in, this was the first new data. It's called impact data.
Kathleen, if I can come back to my question, though. My question is, what does it do to move that passing mark by one number? How much of an impact does that have on the students' scores?
Look at the numbers. I mean, I think it, I don't, I mean, you'd have to, all the numbers are out there. There's a ton of numbers. I mean, does it impact the student scores? Does it impact the,
it
impact
does it suddenly
scores?
Mean everybody passes? What does it mean?
I think it significantly increased the number of students that passed the writing exam this year.
Mm-hmm. But
27 to 53 is my, for one of the grades. But I don't have all those numbers in front of me, so I don't. I mean, you can get those off the DOE website.
Mm-hmm. So going from a 27 to a 53, though, you've still got, that's a big jump from the mark up in the 80s that it was previously. So is that even still a satisfactory development by making that great adjustment? Does that...
I guess the question is really, do we think that students should be able to write a sentence with a comma and a punctuation and a and the appropriate spelling? And again, you know, you have to go to the larger goal. The larger goal is to hopefully prepare every student for a job and a in the global economy. And the U.S. nation has dropped from being in the top two or three competitive education systems in the world to 25. Mm-hmm. We are not. I was down in Miami last night on Education Nation on a panel with CEOs, and it is, you know, 53% of Florida businesses who have jobs can't hire graduating seniors. And you know what the number, one of the top three goals that they're missing? One is the ability to communicate. Two is the ability for critical thinking. And three is the ability to write anything that can be sent out on to a customer or anything else. Mm-hmm. So all these things are very important skill sets. And what we as the Board of Education, working with the superintendents and the teachers and the principals and the teachers' union, we're trying to say, okay, in two years, in 2014 and 2015, these national tests are coming.
Right.
They're not. This is not. So we have 2 years. So we could be passive and do nothing and not be testing our students and not raising the bar, and then we're going to have a disaster on our hand in 2014, 2015.
Stand by,
right,
Kathleen Shanahan.
Right now we see ourselves as leading.
Kathleen Shanahan, stand by if you could. We're talking about the recent batch of FCAT scores, which dropped dramatically when results were released last week. I'm joined by Mike Cahill, president of the Orange County Teachers Association, Winter Park High School physics teacher Gail Hodges, and on the phone by Kathleen Shanahan, chair of the Florida Board of Education. Mike Cahill, what's your thought on not enough development being given down the line to teachers and preparing throughout all the districts in terms of how these new FCAT standards were going to be implemented and the new test itself?
Well, first of all, I think that the DOE needs to take a real good look at the test itself. They need to investigate that. Then they need to investigate how it was scored. And then they need to see what the variables are. They talk about one of the things that people want is critical thinking. Well, a lot of this with these high-stakes tests are being forwarded as a teacher to make sure that the students pass the test. And this leaves out the creativity and the critical thinking parts of many of our classrooms. One of the things that they keep on talking about is comparing us to these other countries, like Finland, Singapore, and so forth. Yet we're going in the opposite direction of the Finland area to Singapore. The biggest problem we have, if you look through the educational system, those countries truly value education. Okay? In America, we keep on depleting it. We keep on pulling money out to grow and get better. There are three areas that really need to be looked at in education if we're going to change it. Number one is the politicians that are involved in it. Number two are the business people that are in it. And number three are the educators themselves. We ourselves have to take charge and move in the right direction for all children. America has one thing over every other country. We teach everybody. And we do it from early childhood to full adult.
Big fundamental questions there. That's the issues we're talking about. I hear from all voices in this conversation. But let me ask you at a more practical level, Mike Cahill, given what we heard Kathleen saying about not having enough communication, maybe from the top all the way down at the Tallahassee level, all the way down to the local district, does this indicate there's some fundamental flaw in the way that the groups are communicating?
Absolutely. But and the other thing is, you know, we talk about FCAT. And as Dr. Hodges was talking about, one of the things FCAT doesn't give us the opportunity is the diagnostic test. When we give a mid-test or end of the semester test, we're able to take that test and, as a teacher and look through it and diagnostically work on things that we need to improve to make every child be a super learner.
So, but what do you think would be a step forward to improve the communication process?
The first thing is to have classroom teachers that are their hands-on, be able to sit down at each one of the counties, a small little group, and give their input on each individual area. The other thing is we really need to take a look at our curriculum. And I think Kathleen hit it right on a point when she was talking about that. Our curriculum is not vast enough. We seem to push everybody into this one little bitty hole that says, you're all going to college. Now, we believe in the rigorous, but we believe in rigorous on both sides, on the technical side and also on the academic.
Well, Kathleen.
We support that. I mean, that's a huge, that's been a very significant mission. I mean, I think what we're seeing in education is some fundamental shifts in terms of the switching of, you know, application of technology, application of digital learning. I think Gail mentioned that, you know, a lot of these tests are given on an online basis. I think these are some of the goals of the national standards that we're all trying to work towards together. And I think it's really important to, you know, the dual enrollment that is very unique in Florida that we offer at our high schools that allow high school students to have exposure to certification programs or college programs that gives them the ability to say, I can go here and take an FPL certification class at Miami-Dade College or a Gulf Power certification up in the Panhandle and graduate from that two-year course and get a $40,000 to $70,000 a year job.
Is what Mike's saying, though, Kathleen, is this anything new you're hearing at the district level, or are these problems that you're aware of? How do you address those fundamental communication issues that seem to have led to this?
I think that, you know, communication is a challenge that we all face every day. And you can, I mean, we have so many communication devices, but are we really hearing what they're telling us? I think we can always do better. I think teachers are part of every step. There are teacher groups that are part of every evaluation, every makeup of everything that the Department of Education does. They're incorporated. I was at a digital task force learning council two or three weeks ago over in Pinellas, and probably a third of the group were teachers, a third were business, and a third were technology people. And we were saying what's working in classrooms, what's not working in classrooms. So, could it be more? Could it be better? Absolutely.
Gail Hodges, you're in the classroom now. What do you think?
Well, I'm sure that they do have teachers on their committees. The problem is are the classroom teachers or are these pull-out teachers that are coaches and CRTs and people who haven't been in the classroom in the last two or three years, because the classroom is changing. It is becoming a more intricate monopoly of students. And consequently, if you haven't taught in the last three or four years, you truly haven't taught the 21st century student. And that's what they really need to consult, is teachers who have been teaching the 21st century students. So I'm sure they have teachers on their committees. I don't doubt that one bit. My question is, when was the last time these teachers were responsible for 25, 30 students' actual educational learning?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me throw out the general question as our time comes to an end here. Where are we going forward now? Is there an investigation going on, Kathleen Shanahan, and what should we anticipate coming out?
Well, Burroughs, which is a well-recognized educational institute, I forget what state they're in. I want to say they're somewhere in the Midwest. They were brought on last year, and we started making changes to these testing to do I don't know if the word's audit or an analysis, whatever, they were brought in on a parallel path based on, some interactions with Pearson a couple of years ago. And mm-hmm. as we started to make changes to the test, both the writing as well as the other raises with the FCAT 2.0. So their report is due out some point this July or early, late summer. And, this will be part of their diagnostic evaluation in terms of what happened. And they are very well respected. They're totally independent from the department and, frankly, totally independent from – they're not based here in Florida.
Well, that's Kathleen Shanahan. She's chair of the Florida Board of Education. Kathleen, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And
enjoyed
we,
everybody. Everybody have a great day. Gail, good luck with the end of school.
Thank you.
Gail Hodges, physics teacher at Winter Park High School. Good to have you with us. Also speaking with Mike Cahill, who is president of the Orange County Teachers Association. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Up next on Intersection 90.7 Newsroom, intern Whitney Hamrick reports on bicycle safety in Central Florida. Orlando is the most dangerous city in the nation for bicycle and pedestrian fatalities, according to the 2012 benchmark survey by the Alliance for Biking and Walking. That statistic resonated for WMFE's newsroom intern, Whitney Hamrick, especially after the death of her friend, cyclist Michael Pandel, in a crash with a car early this year. Whitney Hamrick spent the past semester reporting about how Pandel's friends are working to improve road safety in Central Florida and keep his memory alive.
A bike covered in reflective tape glows in the beam of headlights. It's known as a ghost bike and stands fastened to a road sign in honor of Michael Pandel. Pandel was an avid cyclist who died after being hit by a car at the end of January at the intersection of Hanging Moss Road and State Road 436 in northeast Orlando. Motivated and inspired by her friend's penchant for safety, Averill Busby wants to help prevent future accidents in Pandel's honor.
He was very concerned. He was always the one wearing the helmet, wearing the bright colors, doing what was right while riding.
Less than a week after the accident, she held a one-day fundraiser at the Electric Needle Hut, a local tattoo shop. With the help of artists who volunteered their time, she created a series of tattoos featuring some of Pandel's favorite things.
Triforces and bananas and Finn from Adventure Time and Deadpool and Ninja Turtles and stuff like that.
The event raised $1,300, and Pandel's friends now have a lasting memorial on their skin. Busby wants the money to help place more yellow caution signs and share the road signs on dangerous roads. She spent months after the accident trying to contact the appropriate government agency. Through a series of redirected phone calls and listening to on-hold Muzak, she finally got through to the city of Orlando. It was a piece of cake. Busby says her call was returned the next day.
And the guy said that he'd put two signs up on Hanging Moss within 10 days, and they did. It was very easy and great to work with them, and I didn't even have to give them any money. They just volunteered to put them up.
Busby is still searching for the appropriate offices to contact in Winter Park and hopes the next round of phone calls will produce similar results. For now, Busby knows how to avoid the more dangerous Winter Park roads like Aloma and Fairbanks Avenues, but since the loss of her friend, avoiding the issue still isn't enough. According to the state of Florida, bicycles are considered vehicles and must operate in the road with traffic. In Orlando, cyclists will receive a citation for operating on sidewalks. Cycling advocate Carrie Caffrey is the co-founder of Bike Savvy, an Orlando-based organization that teaches cyclists how to operate in traffic. In the intersection where Pandel's accident occurred, Caffrey waits for the light to turn green as vehicles rumble past.
All of our traffic laws are designed for drivers to pay attention to what is right in front of them, not what's off to the side, not what's coming up from behind them, but what's right in front of them. And so, as a result, if you are operating where you're going to be right in front of people, you're much safer than if you're off to the side.
To make roads safer, Caffrey and Busby both contend that the solution comes down to vigilance, awareness, and continued education. With the $1,300 safely tucked away, Averill Busby plans to partner with Pandel's former employer, a comic shop, to create a nonprofit organization dedicated to bicycle safety awareness. While the group continues to develop this organization, the ghost bike stands a lasting memorial of Michael Pandel, decorated with pinwheels, candles, gifts, and love notes. I'm Whitney Hamrick, 90.7 WMFE News.
You can find out more about Intersection by heading to our website, wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.